From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
Barbie, the beautiful pouty 12-inch fashion model, is 50 years old. Her waistline is a teeny bit thicker, and she smiles more now. In fact, she smiles perpetually now. And she still has her dream house and her car and her boyfriend Ken with the flocked head, who is physically unable to consummate his love for Barbie or even put his arm around her. Robin Gerber is my guest this week. And she is the author of books on Eleanor Roosevelt and Katharine Graham, and her new book tells the story of Ruth Handler, the woman who brought Barbie to life. The book is fascinating, and it's called Barbie and Ruth. Robin Gerber, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the first time I saw a Barbie doll, I said, this is a toy for girls? You know, I was sort of hoping for a 5'9" version of the doll. So was there any resistance to such a shapely doll?
Well, yes, there was, and actually it's funny that you said that, because the doll was, the prototype for the Barbie doll was actually a doll that Ruth Handler found when she was on a family trip to Europe in the 1950s. And the doll she saw, which you would think was a Barbie, looked a lot like a Barbie, was actually a German gag sex toy for men.
Yeah.
So you're not far off the mark in thinking that about the doll. Ruth encountered a tremendous amount of resistance. She took her about 7 years to convince her all-male research and design team and her husband that mothers would actually buy a doll with breasts for their daughters. The men were quite sure that that would never happen. But Ruth was determined. She had one big idea, which was that little girls really did want to play at being big girls, at being women. And they had no doll with which to do that, because all the dolls at the time were baby dolls.
And it's not just her breasts, although they are prominent, but her expression was so unique. She doesn't, Barbie no longer has that expression, but she wasn't smiling, and she wasn't even looking at you. She would always look the other way, no matter how you held her.
Yeah, and that's very much taken from this doll, which was called Lily, this German doll. While Ruth did engineer the Barbie doll with a nicer kind of plastic, it was a bit softer, and she took a bit of the edge off of the face. In fact, the lips were less pouty than the Lily doll, if you can imagine that. And the eyebrows were less arched. So the Lily doll had more of the look of a prostitute, and in fact had been taken from a German cartoon of a character called Lily, who was very popular, and Lily was a prostitute in this cartoon, sort of a gold digger kind of girl. And so she did have that look, and the first Barbies didn't stray terribly far from that.
So it brings a whole new meaning to Barbie's dream house. You could have a...
Oh, yes.
Barbie's dream brothel with Midge and whoever you want. Well, tell us, how did Ruth Handler get into the toy business?
Well, it is a wonderful story. It's a great love story, too, because Ruth Handler and her husband, Elliot, were both children of Polish-Jewish immigrants living in Denver. Ruth was actually the 10th and last child of her parents, who never spoke English. And her mother was so ill after she had Ruth that she actually gave Ruth to Ruth's oldest sister. So she was not raised in the family household. And that sister turned out not to be able to have children, so Ruth was her only child, in quotes, who she doted on very much. And this sister named Sarah was a real entrepreneur herself. She ran a deli counter. Her husband ran a liquor store. So Ruth grew up seeing that women could work. After she married her high school sweetheart, Elliot, they decided to go to L.A., where the weather was nicer. And he was wonderful, wonderful artist and designer, but a very shy man. He couldn't even order his own dinner in a restaurant, according to Ruth. But she was the opposite, and she thought he was a genius and took what he made, and in the beginning he made sort of knickknacks out of a new material called Lucite. You remember that?
Sure.
And she took these Lucite knickknacks, like ashtrays and bookends, and marched out and sold them, and discovered that she was a tremendous salesperson, a tremendous marketing person, and that was how they began.
So her genius was in marketing then?
It really was in marketing and sales. She really could sell anything and quickly understood that she could sell anything. And when Elliot started playing around with dollhouse furniture, she said, that's clever, I'm going to sell that. And she took a train, knowing absolutely nobody, took a train, leaving her two little toddlers with Elliot, took a train all the way to New York, across the country, literally not even knowing a person or a contact, marched into the toy building, and ended up with some representatives who sold that dollhouse furniture. And that first year that Mattel was born, when they sold the dollhouse furniture, they made a 30% return on what they spent, and it was the biggest return that Mattel would ever have.
I guess they plowed a lot of their money into development of new ideas.
Absolutely, and you know, it's a great story that really resonates today. I mean, this is what will make us great again and keep us great, and that is that there were banks willing to lend money to two brash, you know, young 22-year-olds who said that they could build a business, and there were creative people who were willing to come and work for them for not very much in the beginning, and there was a marketplace, an open marketplace, which is what America offers, even today, to entrepreneurs. So this is, you know, it really is the story of a great American company that was built in the most Horatio Alger kind of way.
In fact, they went west. We're talking with Robin Gerber, and her book is called Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Ruth Handler was sort of a visionary in the world of marketing to kids. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, it was a grown-up's world, and a very small portion was given over to kids. And, you know, now it's like a kid's world where us grown-ups are kind of out of place. And I think Ruth Handler played a role in that transition, in that she was certain that having television commercials and television shows aimed at a kid's market would be fruitful.
Yes. I'm afraid we have her to thank for the state of affairs today. It's true. And let me just say, we shouldn't forget that she was doing all this at a time when women really didn't do it. I mean, Mattel was founded in 1945. She really was working in an industry entirely dominated by men. There were some women executives at that time, but the ones who were running companies really had either inherited or taken over from their husbands. So she was a very, very unique woman in that way. But yes, in the marketing side of it, she saw the potential to not only advertise on television, which toy companies didn't do in the 50s, even up to the 50s, that rather than just put out a catalog aimed at parents right before Christmas, which is what they used to do, and the catalog would say, you should get this for your child, and the children had nothing to say about it, Ruth saw the potential for television, and Walt Disney made an offer through her PR company. She got this offer that if she was willing to put up $500,000 for an entire year of advertising, something no toy company had ever done, that she could advertise on a new show in 1955 called the Mickey Mouse Club. And $500,000.
I say we watched it every day, right?
Even then Disney was a brand, but still the show was new. It was a big gamble. There'd never been a show like it. And her PR firm said to her, they're demanding this money up front, and we know it's the entire net worth of Mattel at that time was $500,000.
Wow.
And Ruth said, we're going to go for it. And that made all the difference. And ironically, that year, Louis Marks, who was the head of Marks Toys, the biggest toy company at that time, he was on the cover of Time magazine. And he was quoted as saying, I only spent $300 on television this year. Toys will never be sold on television. And in that same article, a bunch of toy companies were mentioned. Mattel wasn't even mentioned.
I don't think Marks even exists anymore, do they?
It does not. In fact, within 10 years, Ruth had bested Marks, went out of business. A number of her competitors went out of business.
Well, now, so she founded the company in 1945 and didn't come up with Barbie till 1959. What kind of toys did Mattel make at the beginning?
Oh, a lot of toys you and I loved, and many people who are listening. Elliot, like I said, was just a genius in terms of design and coming up with ideas. And their very first toy was modeled on the TV show, you know, Arthur Godfrey. Any listeners remember Arthur Godfrey?
Sure.
The hugely popular show on radio and television. And Arthur Godfrey played a ukulele. And Elliot had the idea of making a toy ukulele like Arthur Godfrey's. And they called it the Yukadoodle. And that was the very first toy that they made. And so they started out in musical toys. They made a piano, a little miniature toy piano, which I remember having, with real raised keys that had never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, black and white keys.
The Yukadoodle had a little crank on the side of it that you turned, or no? That's something
No, the Yukadoodle did not. That came later. That was another innovation. The idea of making that crank that we remember in Jack in the Box,
yep.
for instance.
Yeah.
And there was a cowboy guitar
that
you might
be
remembering.
That's the one, yes. Uh-huh.
Yes, that had the crank. So one of their innovations was the idea of taking some mechanism like that, that was actually the first one, the crank, and putting it in a bunch of different toys. So they put it in the Jack in the Box, the cowboy guitar, they put it in a little monkey, you know, kind of organ grinder monkey toy with different songs. So they're manufacturing that same inside part and wrapping it in something different. And that became a you know, a method of maximizing these innovations. Like if you remember the Chatty Cathy doll in the 60s.
And yes, you pulled the string and Chatty Cathy would talk to you. Right?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And with random sentences,
yes. remember,
random phrases, which was also an innovation, not the same thing every time. That same mechanism is what went into the See and Say toys.
Many years later.
Right. Exactly. But you're talking about the same, essentially the same mechanism. So
I remember there was, in addition to Chatty Cathy, they had Mattie Mattel, right?
Right.
And I had a Bugs Bunny doll that actually had Mel Blanc's voice saying things when you pulled the string.
There you go. So it was, as you can see, building on a good idea and maximizing that idea, of course, for a company is very, very cost effective. The other thing Ruth did that was an innovation was most toy companies decided to make a particular kind of toy, and then they bought the machinery and the materials, and that's what they made. But that locked them in to making something in that way. She saw that Elliot's mind was so far-ranging, his creativity, that rather than do that, she subcontracted. So that way, if you want to work in a new material, use a different kind of manufacturing method, they wouldn't be locked in. So that allowed them to come up with really innovative toys.
But right. So rather than say, just only make Tinker Toys, because that's what the Tinker Toy Company made, they made a variety of things.
Yeah. For instance, guns was another big one in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot was, you know, he and his all-man team, the boys love the guns. And, of course, it was the beginning of the great westerns on television in the 50s, you know, Gunsmoke and Bonanza and all these shows, remember. And so they had the Fanner 50 pistol,
mm-hmm.
which was extremely realistic.
I still want one of those, by the way.
You can still get it on eBay.
Oh, okay.
And they had a Winchester rifle, which was so realistic when they went to get the patent from Winchester, and they were sitting at the table, and Ruth pointed the toy at one of the executives. He dodged under the table because it looked so good.
I remember a Mattel belt buckle that was tied, I think it was tied to Maverick, but I'm not sure, and you would flex your stomach, and the little pop gun would pop out of the belt buckle, and it was great.
That's great. I don't remember that one.
let me just ask you a little bit more about Barbie. We're talking with Robin Gerber, and her book is called Barbie and Ruth. And it's the wonderful story of the origin of Barbie and Ruth Handler, the creator, who had a magnificently interesting life. But Barbie and Ken, maybe the reason that they couldn't really get together physically was because they're brother and sister, I guess, because they're both named after her children.
Yes. Well, that's an interesting viewpoint. Yes, they were named after her children, who always resented it and thought it was just an awful idea. And Barbara, who is still alive, still refuses to be called Barbie.
But Barbie...
And Ken, of course, was a bit annoyed about the fact that the Ken doll was, well, shall we say, missing a part.
That's right. Not anatomically correct. But, you know, Barbie, you're beautiful. You make me feel my Barbie doll is really real.
Yes, was the first commercial.
Yeah, I remember it well. Well, let me ask you about, you're a feminist and famous for that, and you write a lot about powerful women. There was kind of a backlash against Barbie. I mean, the image, you know, I mean, in your book you talk about how one of the marketing tools that Ruth Handler was hoping for was that little girls would want to be Barbie when they grew up. And then when those women did grow up, they were resentful of having this image thrust upon them, and You know, they blamed Barbie for their anorexic behavior and things like that.
Well, let me correct you a little bit. She didn't want them to want to be Barbie when they grew up. She just wanted to give them something to play with that they could pretend to be whatever they wanted to be when they grew up. So the doll was really more of a Rorschach for them. You know, she observed her daughter playing with paper dolls, adult paper dolls, and she saw that the girls just liked to pretend that they were grown up and played like women and not be confined to being women who were mommies, who only had baby dolls to play with. So she wasn't that she had any particular intention that they either look like this doll or be like this doll, but she wanted them to be able to fantasize about being adult women. That was the big, that really was the big idea. And that, it is a feminist idea because what she was saying is you don't only have to be mothers. In fact, she wasn't very happy as a mother at all. She was quite open about this. She told a newspaper reporter, "I would have been the most mixed up, miserable person if I'd stayed home with my children." So I think it makes a lot of sense from who she was that she said, and I think probably she as a little girl thought this way, gee, I'd like to play and think about whatever I might want to be when I grow up. So that was really the idea of the doll, which I think is a feminist idea. Now, the fact that the culture has taken this iconic doll, which has become so huge globally, and, you know, put upon it, and I think very much an adult interpretation, that this doll is giving girls bad images of themselves. And not to say that that doesn't happen. I think it probably does happen. Didn't happen with my daughter, but, you know, I'm sure that it does happen with some. I think that that's also true. I think that Barbie does now represent the objectification of women, which women like myself really want to see ended. So, you know, both things are going on at the same time.
Right. I mean, in the same way that Mattel had to get out of the gun trade because there was suddenly a political backlash against guns. I mean, I remember one season on Gunsmoke. You know, every season began with Matt Dillon shooting somebody in the street. And then all of a sudden it was freeze, you know, and guns were out. And so I guess they had to stop making guns, right?
Yeah, there was, you know, in the beginning, that when they got the backlash, Elliot's comment about that was, you know, it's up to parents to deal with this with their children. Little boys are always going to pick up a stick and pretend it's a gun. So, but later, you know, when really guns became such a problem in this country, even Ruth said, you know, today I think we wouldn't manufacture guns. So they did really move on that issue. But when it came to Barbie, she was very adamant that little girls were still doing with that doll exactly what they had always done. And I think on that she was right in terms of little girls. In terms of adult women, there was a lot of anger about the doll and how it contributed to a whole culture of objectification. It's certainly not just Barbie we have to blame.
Well, of course not. Well, but let's talk a little bit about gender-specific dolls. I mean, Barbie was intended for girls, and then I guess this ideal that came out with G.I. Joe. Did Mattel kind of miss the boat on boy dolls? I mean, they had Ken, but...
Yeah, I think they were worried, as I talk about in the book, and, you know, they were worried when G.I. Joe came out. No one had made a successful toy doll for boys. And I think they had it right when they came out with G.I. Joe and, you know, gave him this backstory that made him very tough and very military, and he was all jointed all over the place.
Yeah, you could
so
get...
So that was very...
Your G.I. Joe could get it on with your Barbie, whereas your Ken couldn't, right?
Yeah, yes, that's right. G.I. Joe had
I mean, he still didn't have a thing.
Yeah, he had some possible potential there, more than Ken. And, I think that Mattel got outfoxed on that one. But they were doing so well in the 60s, they weren't worried about it. I mean, Barbie was such a phenomena, and then later in the 60s, Elliot came up with Hot Wheels, which also, next to Barbie, is the biggest brand that he and Ruth came out with. And, you know, that was a company unto itself, so... G.I. Joe gave them a little run for their money. It wasn't that much.
Well, tell us a little bit about, I mean, we're just sort of skimming the surface of your book because your book is about so much more in terms of the incredible, interesting life of Ruth Handler. But she did get into some legal trouble with Mattel. What was that?
Oh, yes, she did. I think that she was the kind of person who had the right personality to be a founder of a company, you know, someone who just didn't take no for an answer ever, who had incredible resiliency, toughness, and moxie. But it got her into trouble. Mattel got to be, of course, the biggest toy company in the world. The 60s were a golden age for Mattel. They went public. They were the darling of Wall Street. And she became convinced that the company couldn't grow anymore, and she really was only interested in getting bigger and competing. And this was really what drove her. It certainly wasn't about money at this point, because she had more than she could ever spend. And so she came up with a plan to buy other companies using the high-flying stock of Mattel. And when they had a bad quarter, not wanting Wall Street to know because they didn't want the stock price to drop, she conspired with other executives to cook the books, essentially. And this all came in the beginning of the 70s, right at the time that she also got breast cancer and lost a breast to breast cancer. So it was a very nightmarish time. The scheme began to unravel. She and Elliot were pushed out of Mattel in 1975, and in 1978 she pleaded no contest, essentially a guilty plea to committing fraud, federal fraud, and was given a very, very long community service sentence, the longest given in white-collar crime up to that time.
But no prison time.
No prison time. I think from the research I did, I would say she was lucky in a couple of ways. She got a judge who was a very sympathetic judge. They certainly pleaded her age and illness, particularly her illness. And her co-conspirator also got the community service sentence, and he was taking care of a very, very ill wife. So I think the judge did take pity on them in that way. But she got 5 years of 500 hours a year.
Wow.
Of community service.
It's a full-time
job.
So
that was, yes, exactly. And by that time, she had founded a new company making naturally formed breast prosthetics, breast inserts for women like herself who'd had mastectomies. And she really found this incredible satisfaction in going around the country, personally fitting women, seeing how she helped them get their dignity back as, you know, as she had helped herself. And so she begged the judge to let her give away these prosthetics as part of her community service to poor women, and he said, absolutely not. So she had to do that sentence, you know, doing other kinds of jobs.
And did she give away the prosthetic breasts anyway?
Yes, she did. In fact, and which is exactly what he said to her.
But so she was really a pioneer in that research, yes?
Oh, totally. The only breast on the market. I mean, she just completely came from her own experience. After she lost her breast, she went to get a prosthetic, and it was a horrible experience. The salespeople were, you know, really sort of embarrassed by her. They didn't want to look at her. They kind of threw this globby thing over the door of the changing room. And it was just humiliating. And at that time in the early 70s, most women did not get reconstruction. And women really felt, women were really in the closet who had had mastectomies. You know, it was something that people didn't talk about. Women were ashamed of.
People didn't talk about breast cancer at all, really, did they?
That's right. That's right. If you lost your breast, you know, it was something people whispered about. And she became determined to, in her own words, bring it out of the closet. And so she went to the biggest companies, Neiman Marcus and Bloomingdale's, and created salons and that just personally fit these women. And she insisted on training every employee down to the stock boys, and she would give them a lecture about, you know, women like her, and then she would, you know, make them come up, and she'd grab the hand of one of these guys, and she'd say, "Feel my breast, see if you can tell which one's the fake one." She even went on TV and opened her blouse, you know.
Really?
The famous picture of her in People magazine doing the same thing, you know, pulling her blouse open. She was quite well endowed, by the way.
Well, maybe that's why Barbie is also.
I think it's probably why she didn't really think about it that much, you know. I don't think the dimensions of the doll really stood out to her. Think of two things. She was living in Los Angeles, where, you know,
yes,
a lot of women were curvaceous. She herself was quite curvaceous, and she really wanted this doll to have clothes that look good. Ruth was very into dressing beautifully, and she didn't think the clothes could look good unless the doll had a real shape. So those were really the factors she was thinking of. It never occurred to her, I think, at all, that she was somehow communicating to little girls, this is how you have to look.
And the clothes and shoes, we didn't really talk about that, were so intricately made with their little snaps and things.
Yeah, she was a stickler for quality in every product that she made. But Barbie was her special project, and she hired a wonderful designer right out of fashion school in Los Angeles and sent her to Japan for a year, where this woman worked directly with the seamstresses, picking out the fabrics. Remember, if you think about it, you can't have a fabric with a big pattern on it because you're making these tiny clothes.
Right, they're going to be tiny.
So there are a lot of things to think about, and so this was really a labor of love to make these fantastic clothes, which, of course, it was the razor blade theory. You know, once you bought one doll, then you were going to buy untold numbers of outfits.
Because mix and match is fun to do. What Barbie will wear is up to you.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. So that was also her genius, because the doll she found in Germany, you could only buy the doll with its outfit. And if you asked to buy a separate outfit, they looked at you like you were crazy. You had to buy another doll to get another outfit. And she immediately saw that that was stupid marketing.
Well, when Barbie came out, she was like $1.98 or something, and the clothes could be as much as $5, right?
Yes, the clothes. It's still that way today, actually. You can buy a Barbie doll for $5.
Yeah.
But it's the clothes that are going to get you.
and you're going
and the accessories.
And you're going to lose the shoes. For some reason, the shoes, they get lost. I don't know what happens to the shoes, but they get vacuumed up. If you open the vacuum cleaner bag, you find all the shoes in there. That's
the same thing happens to the socks in your washing machine.
Also, there was a black Barbie. I think that was probably an innovation, yeah?
Yes. In the 60s, I think 67, they came out with a black Barbie. I mean, there's the company has certainly, even today, you know, long after Ruth is out of the company, like any company, it's following what it thinks are the desires of its consumers. And so as little girls played with Barbie and that first year, they started writing in and saying, we want a boyfriend for this doll. And that's why Ken came along. And in focus groups, they could see the doll, they were making the doll into all kinds of different professions. And so they started marketing the doll with different professions. So it really, and then, of course, the ethnicity, I think there was some social demand for that. And really, Ruth and Elliot Roy's very socially conscious. They were great charitable givers. They had a very non-discriminatory workplace from the beginning. They received awards very early on from the NAACP for the lack of discrimination that they showed back in the 40s and 50s. So they were really ahead of their time in that way.
Barbie, you're beautiful. You make me feel my Barbie doll is really real. Barbie's small and so petite. Her clothes and figure look so neat. Her dancing outfit rings the bell. At parties she will cast a spell. Purses, hats, and gloves galore. And all the gadgets gals adore.
Barbie dressed for swim and fun is only $3. Her lovely fashions range from $1 to $5. Look for Barbie wherever dolls are sold.
Someday I'm gonna be exactly like you. Till then I know just what I'll do. Barbie, beautiful Barbie. I'll make believe that I am you.
It's really a remarkable story. The book is called Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Ruth Handler is that woman, and the author that we've been speaking to is Robin Gerber. Robin, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me.
You can tell it's Mattel. It's swell.
That closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. As always, thanks to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.